Welcome to a Prevent Connect podcast, where we explore the prevention of violence against women. This is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault.
Hello, this is Ashley Meyer with Prevent Connect, and today Prevent Connect is really glad to host a conversation between Abby Sims and Sari Lipset from Prevent Connect with Max Greenberg, who co-authored a chapter with Michael Mesner called Before Prevention, The Trajectory and Tensions of Feminist Anti-Violence.
Hi, everyone. This is Sari Lipset with CalCasa and Prevent Connect.
And this is Abigail Sims with Prevent Connect.
We're so happy to have Max on the phone with us today talking about his article, and we have a lot of interesting things to bring up and talk about. Thank you so much, Max, for being with us.
Great. Thank you for having me.
So, Max, you talk to a lot of people about prevention and the history, or at least the recent history, of anti-violence prevention. How do you feel, have prevention programs changed over the years, and in what ways, and what were some of those catalysts of change?
Well, I think to get the full story about prevention programs, we have to start, as we say in the piece, before prevention. One of the things we point to in the article is that prevention, as we know it today, which is largely through a public health lens, has roots in feminist and social justice movements back in the 1960s and 70s. So before the feminist movement, violence was widely understood as basically the actions of a few bad apples, specifically bad men. And it was women who got together and shared their stories and began to find patterns and precursors of violence that sort of set the stage for us to think about prevention today. So the first programs that resemble what we think of as prevention today probably began with men in the late 70s going out into community centers and communities and talking to young men about violence and pornography. So the major change that we talk about in the piece is institutionalization, specifically of prevention, and sort of how it's been solidified into something clear-cut and distinct and separate from other kinds of work around violence, from work with perpetrators and work with survivors. And I think this has benefits and it has challenges. And I think I'll start by talking about the benefits. A big one is money. You know, prevention work at its sort of dawn in the 60s and 70s was not well funded. You know, the people doing it were either doing it on their days off or they were not that well paid. And today we have a whole world of people who can make this their life's work, which I think is pretty amazing. We also have incredible widespread acceptance. The fact that the White House, you know, launched what is essentially a prevention campaign, you know, a couple weeks ago, is sort of unheard of. And I think in our interviews talking to people who were doing this work, not just 40 years ago, but 10 years ago or 5 years ago, never thought they would see this. And lastly, on the benefits end is access to a huge variety of institutions. You know, prevention used to struggle to find people who would listen to the message, and now prevention programs are in high schools, middle schools, the military, fraternities, the NFL, you know, other sports leagues, and so on. So all that's pretty incredible. But we also in the article want to point to, in the chapter, want to point to some of the challenges that have come up. So among those, I'd say that there's been a rush to develop sort of one-size-fits-all prevention programming that often papers over a lot of the complexity and the roots of violence. I think that the funding landscape for prevention looks increasingly like a marketplace with organizations competing over a growing but still relatively small pool of resources. And lastly, prevention seems to me, and we make the point in the article, to emphasize individual changes and group changes rather than focusing on structure and policy. So there's,
right,
I think, a pressure, yeah, to not rock the boat that much in the institution that you're in. So if a major institution, say a sports league, is going to bring you in to do prevention programming, they're going to be inclined to bring in groups that are going to try to change player culture but aren't going to challenge the fundamental arrangements of the institution and the cultures and policies of that institution.
That's interesting. When I just heard you say listen to the message, I was thinking, like, what is the message? Is the message that prevention is important, or is the message that stopping sexual violence is important? Do you know what I mean? Like, doing prevention act, we value doing prevention activities, or we value a community that does not tolerate sexual violence, or kind of two different things.
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. I mean, I think that I believe to some extent that people in these organizations want to stop sexual assault and rape. You know, as I've heard many people say, you know, few people are pro-rape. But I think that as an approach, it's fundamentally limited. And I think that for them, I can understand why they'd want to do it. You know, prevention is a very alluring goal. You know, it promises to stop all that harm and hurt and loss before it happens. It's very uplifting and promising. And I understand why organizations and institutions would want to pursue it rather than some of the really hard work of working with survivors and talking about perpetrators and developing a more holistic approach. So I understand where that desire comes from.
You have in the article like a really great diagram of the different realms that are of anti-violence, and you call them engagements with sexual and relationship violence. Can you walk us through the different realms and how they relate to one another?
Yeah, so the chart that you're talking to was basically came out of us trying to figure out how to make sense of all of the successes and some of the backlash against feminist anti-violence and anti-violence movements over the last 40 plus years. So it's a 2x2 table with the columns describing the sort of person that is engaged through that sort of realm. So recipients of violence on the left and perpetrators of violence on the right. And the rows talk about a time period. So when is the engagement intended to take place? Either after violence or before violence, and each quadrant or each realm represents the intersection of a person and a time frame. So A is, you know, after violence responses to survivors. So you can think of shelters or support groups. And realm B is responses for perpetrators. So you can think of legal reforms that have been sort of pushed through by feminist movements or counseling or therapy that's aimed at perpetrators of violence. Realm C is before violence for potential targets. So we can think about self-defense or risk reduction. And realm D is prevention, primary prevention with boys and men, most notably. And the argument that we put forth is that increasingly these are quarantined and walled off from each other into sort of institutionalized realms. And as they are, they're pulled apart, and we are trying to make the case that sort of pulling them back together will lead to more effective work, anti-violence work.
So what happens when these realms become disconnected?
So let me focus on prevention. When we start to think about prevention as separate from the other quadrants, I think a few things happen. There's this very powerful documentary called The Invisible War about sexual assault in the military, and there's a moment where the filmmakers ask a cadet about these programs, prevention programs, and her response is that they're a joke. And, you know, we don't claim in the article, and we haven't done any research on the military's programs or their level of effectiveness, but one of the things we wanted to get at was what makes these prevention messages, these prevention programs, which to those people doing the work, myself included, feel very powerful, and the evidence shows to some extent that they're working, and they have this social justice history. How do they feel like a joke to that cadet in that context?
Yeah.
And I think there's a couple ways that this happens. You know, it can make it easy to focus on a top-down attempt to change culture or change behavior, that is very one way, you know, from you can feel like this program has all the answers and it just needs to be taught to the audience. And yes, I think to some extent there's educational pieces and cultural change pieces that need to happen with a variety of groups, but culture also lives in laws and policies and structural inequalities, and I think that that can be lost when prevention is siloed. I also think that prevention needs to be backed up by meaningful responses to violence, for support for survivors and, you know, responses to perpetrators, or else I think to everyone on the ground, it just looks like institutional lip service, and people see through that. I think anyone who goes through a prevention program but then sees that the institution that they're involved in that provided that programming, if they don't sort of walk the walk in supporting survivors and not having meaningful consequences for perpetrators, I think they see that the prevention program, you know, wasn't that meaningful to the institution. And I also think it's important to sort of say that everyone I've met who does prevention cares deeply about the work and works really hard and does amazing things, often for very low pay. And I'm not focusing on them. I think it's the way the system is arranged. And I think we'll actually talk about this on the next podcast. But I think, that it's not the individuals, it's the system.
Right. So, and some of the framing, I was just thinking, your quadrants are really helpful. And part of the way they're helpful is that they're together. And I was just thinking in public health, we talk about primary prevention so much, and we're kind of putting, immediately we put these restrictions on what counts as what. And some of our language, we've been talking to people about, you know, preventing violence before it happens in the first place. And when you do that, and that's your frame, it's possible to lose sight of the actual reality that when human beings are working with other human beings, violence has happened. Like,
yeah,
there is no, you know, like there is no prevent it before it happens. You're not going to get a group of people or somehow screen a group of people who have never had any experience themselves or with a friend or family member or neighborhood or, you know, friend, school, classmate or whatever who has no experience, maybe not a direct experience of victimization and perpetration, but no experience with sexual violence.
Yeah, and those are, that's not only just a meaningful part of human experience, but those are key learning moments and jumping off points to talk about gender-based violence and violence against women. And I think it's a huge oversight to miss talking about those. And I think that you're right. I think that when we focus on prevention as though violence is only something that's off in the distant future, we lose sight of people's real lived experiences and histories and pasts.
Yeah, and that's what I liked about your graphic was that it includes, when things are very close together and inform one thing informs another, then when you're thinking of prevention, you're also thinking of how this intervention may affect people who have experienced violence, or that there are survivors in the room or on the campus or in the workplace. And when you're testing, oftentimes we kind of test materials and pilot materials with our primary audience only, and there are some things that may work well for a primary audience but may not work, may not be sending the message we want to send in the context of beyond that primary audience.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we try to develop a concept in the piece that we call bridge work, which is the way people on the ground try to reconnect these realms that we've laid out. And in my experience, people who do prevention work are always doing this. You know, they're always trying to reconnect, or at least the most successful ones I've seen are always trying to reconnect the realms and be aware of survivors in the room, and the histories of the people in the room and their connection to, you know, whether it's law enforcement or, you know, counseling for violence or things like that. And they try to sort of reconnect those realms on the ground.
You talked about the value of individual level change and the focus on individual level change, which I've definitely seen a lot. And it's, of course, true. We're talking about health behaviors, and you want to see behavior change and skills acquisition. And what are the other things that may be missing when we focus that much on individual change as our only strategy?
So let me tell a story. I've done a fair amount of prevention work, and I've given evaluations, and I've seen significant changes on evaluations. At one point, I recall giving an evaluation and watching a young man fill out the form perfectly, answering all the questions, showing all the sort of changes in attitude that we would want to see. And then as he walked out the door, I heard him down the hall, you know, smack his friend on the behind and say, "I just raped you." I think evaluations can only show us so much. I think that individuals exist in a context beyond that classroom, beyond those programs, and it's important to try to bring that in as much as we can.
I feel like so many people that do prevention or have done prevention would have a similar story.
And I don't know that young man, right? I don't know his beliefs, I don't know his actions, I don't know much about him besides these two pieces of him. And I think for me the key is that both existed in particular social contexts. You know, one in this context of the class, one in the context of this sort of life outside the class and the school. And I think it's hard to put all the weight on the classroom to change everything outside of it. I think we need more than that. We need policies and practices and structural changes if we're hoping primary prevention to have lasting and meaningful results beyond the classes.
Thank you for listening to this Prevent Connect podcast. Prevent Connect is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault, with funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The views presented on Prevent Connect are not necessarily the views of the United States government, the CDC, or CalCASA. To learn more about Prevent Connect, visit www.preventconnect.org. For more information about CalCASA's mission or to show your support, visit calcasa.org. That's CalCASA.org.